choose your stakeholders and your partners carefully, which includes the investors who you bring on board, because you know they're going to be with you on this journey for a while. If you do it very thoughtfully, you will not, as an entrepreneur or as a founder, get pulled in different directions. Now, in our case, what that meant was a couple of things. It meant that there is absolute alignment between the investors and us on the larger mission.
Hi, welcome to another edition of Forbes India Startup Fridays. Weekly conversations with accomplished entrepreneurs, VC investors, and other folk who are doing significant work in India's startup ecosystem. I'm Hari Arakli, and my guest today is Smita Deora. She's co-founder and co-CEO of Boulevard Leadership, better known as Lead School, and I think better to be referred to as Lead. And Smita started out as a CA by training and had a successful corporate career working with companies including PwC and Procter & Gamble. Before starting Lead, Smita started Sparsh, a non-profit organization in the field of education for children from low-income families. Smita and her husband Sumit Mehta started Lead School in 2012. Today, the company touches some 1.4 million students, 3,500 schools in more than 400 cities in India. And these are probably not the latest numbers, as I simply took them from the Lead website. In January this year, the company was valued as a unicorn, meaning it was privately valued at more than $1 billion at its latest round of funding. And they're backed by some stellar investors, including Westbridge, LUR Equity, and GSV Ventures. Smita, wonderful to have you with us this morning. Welcome to Startup Fridays.
Thank you, Hari. It's a pleasure to speak to you and to the rest of the listeners today.
All right. So just to get us started, maybe you could start with the path that brought you to Lead. Maybe give us I know it's a long career, but attempt a snapshot of close to 25 years from CA to CEO and entrepreneur.
Sure. Actually, when you say 25, that's when I start feeling old. Otherwise, I just feel like I started a few years back, to be honest. It's been an interesting journey, and I hope that there are learnings to be taken by others too. See, like most kids, I grew up in a lower middle class family. Engineering, medicine, CA were the path available at that time for us as kids. And my father, being an engineer, saw the world at that time as a little unfair to engineers and more fair to CAs, so convinced me to do CA. And that's when I started. So I started, I used to be bored in college. So I started CA when I was in college, and I started working when I was 18 years old. Okay. So I used to go to college for an hour in the morning, and then I would go to PwC office or whichever client I was placed with during my articleship. And my learning really started there. And I think, you know, as I reflect back, I think my most precious years of learnings were with PwC and at work. I barely learned at college. I never went to college, really. It started there. I very quickly realized that audit, consulting, financial services is not my thing. It doesn't interest me. I wanted to solve real world problems, things I could, see, feel, experience not far away. But my education was finance, and hence the closest I thought at that time I could do was move towards the industry and just focus on my learning. And that is what took me to P&G. And I had a great experience of working at P&G for almost 9 years. Loved working with the company. And there were different experiences there, right? I mean, I joined them in India, but then I moved to Singapore. So now it was living in a very different environment, working with a diverse set of people. I always worked on the business side there. So mostly all my learning and work was on strategy, business. For 5 years, I worked on the Pampers business, which when I joined was a sick business. We were losing market share. We were highly unprofitable. And over the 5 years, I worked with the leadership and learned a lot on how do you turn around a sick business. Around that time is also when I met Sumit. So I think the paths to what I do today, which is education, it began from my partnership with Sumit, because he comes from a family of teachers. And, you know, so education and teaching and learning was out of work conversation for both of us, because he was very passionate about it. Both his parents were teachers, his brother and sister-in-law teachers. So that is when I started paying attention to it, and I started developing some curiosity around it. And then really the second point when this happened was when we were going to become parents. So back in 2007 is when we were expecting our first child. And that's when I started reading a lot about early development. That was also the time when neuroscience started becoming very, started becoming more mainstream. There was a lot more research that was getting published. And I came across, some friend referred, and I came across this neuroscientist, Glenn Doman, who worked with brain injured children, but then had applied his techniques with kids who did not have injuries and had some phenomenal results. And that's when my first set of experiments began with my own firstborn child, who was born in 2008. I was, of course, aware that I'm experimenting by seeing how she learns to read. Knowing now, 14 years later, I know I've done her only good and no damage. But really, you know, I experimented a lot. What that meant was, she became an independent reader when she was, even before she started speaking, when she was barely a year old. And by the time she was 3 years old, she was fully independently reading. No one has ever read a book for her after that age. And the same happened with my younger kid. You know, she used to teach him how to read, and he became an independent reader by the time he was 2.5, 3 years old. And I think that's what opened my mind to what was possible. And I think I just became aware that, you know, what we do or what we provide in the education system to our children is really limited by what we believe is possible. And there is just so much of neuroscience research that's happening, and there's so much of really good research happening in parts of the world. But specifically in India, we're not sort of bringing that research into our thinking and into our innovation in the field of education, because while I was doing this at home, they were going to school, you know, even though it was the best school in the city, I could see that there were differences. So I think that's where the journey of education and journey of LEAD began, from my own parenthood experience, early experience, and then, of course, realizing that there was this big gap between what was happening in the developed part of the world or in countries like Singapore, which are high PISA ranking countries, and versus what was happening in India.
Briefly, tell us what got you all coming back to India?
Yeah, so to be honest, I think it was largely Sumit always wanting to come back and do something in education here. He was quite convinced about that, and he's always been very, very patriotic, always wanted to come back, do something in India. He comes from a small town. So that was one trigger. And the second trigger was of course, our first child coming, getting born. We wanted to be close to parents. Our parents were getting older. I was convinced that, you know, I want my child to have their grandchildren around. We'd lived in Singapore long enough. And I think both these things sort of came together, and we moved back in 2008. End 2007, and both my children are born here in India. And Sumit at that time took up the opportunity to work with ZLearn while I continued with PNG.
Okay, and for folks who are not familiar with, you know, the whole education scene in general and more specifically in India, and I think I have to put myself in that category as well. You mentioned a PISA ranking. Maybe that's also a good way to look at sort of the context for LEAD School. Tell us a little bit about what that ranking is, and you know.
Sure. So you know, a PISA ranking. So PISA are international standard assessments that are done in OECD countries now for many, many years. I believe at least 20, 25 years or even more, and they basically test for application skills across language, math, and science. And truly over time, they have been able to, with PISA assessments, they issue rankings and, rankings for countries on where countries are. And over a period of time, they've been able to actually give a lot of insights into how countries have transformed their education systems for long-term sort of development of the country and for long-term human development, right? And Singapore is amongst the top 10 PISA-ranked countries now for a while. It okay. came from the bottom. So if someone sees Singapore's history, it came from the bottom when they got their freedom to now being amongst the top ranked, you know, and hence it's been a stellar growth. There are a few other countries which have had phenomenal growth, you know, Finland being one of them. And India, and I think that's where it was a very stark difference for me, because I lived for so long in Singapore. And anyone who works in the space of education, you know, tends to know about this, right? Like what's happening in the world. And coming to India, see, India participated in PISA maybe 10 years back or 8 or 9 years back. Sorry, I don't recall the exact year. And out of the 74 countries that participated, India was ranked 73. And we in our I don't know what to call that mindset, whether it's ignorance or whether it is overconfidence. We said, hey, this doesn't make sense. Let's not participate in PISA. And we never participated after that. We are now going to participate, you know, in the coming year, I believe. It was supposed to be 2021. And you can hence see the difference, right, between these two. And that, I think, was also the trigger for both Sumit and me, for Sumit to come back to India and for me to choose to move away from other fields to education, because I was reading all this and I was seeing live what was happening, what was possible with my own children, what was happening in their schools. And then, you know, there was this personal experience, which I know, Hari, when you and me were chatting, you brought that up. Maybe it's helpful to share here that, you know, in 2010, maybe, you know, my second kid was also born, and I was, you know, my experiments with my older one was working quite well. And I used to wonder what is happening inside these slums, you know, which are like in Mumbai, all apartment blocks are surrounded by slums. And I decided to walk in and visit my maid and see what community she lives in and what sort of Anganwadis or schools, preschools that are run by the government, what do they do? And I was just heartbroken when I saw that. I saw these kids who were the same age as my biologically born child, but they were basically all just crammed in the space. The teacher didn't know what to do with them. Parents had left them because, of course, parents had to go to work. And these kids just did not, there was just immense possibility there, because if my kid can learn to read, well, all kids can learn to read, but they just had no exposure. And I think when I saw this gap, I was like, okay, this is exactly what PISA is saying. And you know, so how do I then solve that problem? And I think that is when my personal journey in the space of education began.
And you started out by creating Sparsh first. Maybe we can just briefly talk about that and actually then get into LEAD itself.
Yeah, so it actually comes out of this story or this experience of basically two things really bothering me. One is that the quality of education and the way education is approached in India is not research oriented, is very, very behind where the rest of the world is. And the second is that there is lack of equity. What's available to kids who are coming from well-off families, you know, in some of the high fee schools, private schools, versus what is available to kids en masse is very different. And, you know, when we talk about India being great, well, India can't be great if we can't democratize education, if we don't provide excellent education to all kids and then give them an opportunity for them to really do well from that platform. So I think these were the two pain points. And the second one pained me enough for me to say, hey, this is not a retirement plan. I want to do something about it now. I don't want to sit and sip wine, have a great job, earn money, sip wine and say, hey, India is plagued with these problems. That's not me. For those of, for people who know me personally very well, they know I either take action or I accept. If I believe I can't do anything about it, I will accept that I can't, and, you know, not comment on it. And here I decided to take action. And my first action was to set up a nonprofit, Sparsh, I created a school in a box solution for preschools, for these Anganwadis. There were 16 Anganwadi centers that I worked with. Half of them were voluntarily sort of working with my NGO. The other half were working through a government pilot. So it took me a year to get alignment from the government to do a pilot. And that's what Sparsh did at that time. And after 3 years of doing that, I think there were two big takeaways for me, Hari. One was that this is definitely what I want to dedicate my life to, because it was a complex problem to solve. And it was, I love solving complex things. You know, I'm a nerd and a geek as far as that is concerned. And at the same time, my other learning was that I just don't have the patience to work with the government. It was just too slow. And that is what took me to the journey of LEAD, where in 2012, Sumit and me set up a school in a village in Gujarat. And in the meantime, what happened was, of course, Sumit also, of course, I was also a bit of a catalyst there, but you know, this big divide between kids who are coming from low-income communities or coming from small towns versus high-fee schools was a point of discussion. And he left Z. I convinced him to leave Z. And then, you know, both of us, Z Learn is what I mean. And then both of us started a school in Gujarat, in a village in Gujarat, which was the genesis of LEAD. We set up 4 more schools after that in Maharashtra, all in small towns. That's where the LEAD product got built, and then we slowly started sort of going the partnership route. So Sparsh work actually led into LEAD, and that's where the education work and education journey began, really. And we moved from non-profit to for-profit, more for sustainability, growth, you know, just having our ability to take action a lot more in our hand versus being dependent on the government. To be honest, right. I mean, that was the reason why we moved into a for-profit structure.
All right. When you set up the first school at LEAD and the subsequent few ones in Maharashtra, at that point, what was in your mind? What did you want to do in those schools that would be different in the context of, you know, like you said, providing affordable, high-quality education? And then maybe we can talk about what LEAD has evolved into today.
Sure. So, see, I think the challenge that we were constantly seeing in these schools, if I have to crystallize it into, you know, why learning was not happening in these schools. And when I say these schools, I mean even private schools. So as context, right, India has 1.5 million schools with 280 to 90 million school going kids. Right. And out of those 1.5 million schools, 1 million schools are government schools and 500,000 are private schools. Now, for all of us who are Indians, we know that government schools have unfortunately never stood for high quality. There has always been a challenge of quality there. And that is the reason why for any parent, their aspiration when they have any amount of disposable income is to send their child to an English medium private school. That's the aspiration of every Indian parent. You know, and we were seeing that, right? Like staff that was supporting us, that's what they wanted. They were taking the kids out of these Anganwadis and putting them in preschools, private preschools, or taking them to school. So, you know, that's where we said, hey, let us just set up a school, run a private school. You know, clearly these parents afford. And then let's build from there and see what needs to be solved in education. And why are these private, like, how do you run a really good high quality private school? Now, high quality private school in our mind was always the benchmark, was what we were seeing in the international schools, in the IB system, and what we were seeing in some of the, you know, other countries outside. So I did a lot of extensive work in, you know, by visiting schools, whether it was Finland or Singapore or, you know, which are these high ranked PISA countries, to see what were they doing. So our initial idea was to bring these practices to our own school and then take it from there. And as we started that, we essentially realized that, you know, if we crystallize this really into a few things, there were 3 big problems that we're seeing in these low-fee private schools, right, in India. One was students had big learning gaps because they had no home support. Their parents were not educated, and hence they really, really relied on the school to be able to provide them that learning. And largely they were behind grade level. And, you know, now there's enough of data and report that has been provided by Pratham through their ASAR reports, where you can see that grade 5 kids are at grade 3 reading levels, a grade 5 kid can barely do grade 2 or grade 3 addition subtraction. So that is something that we were seeing live in all the kids who were coming to our schools. I mean, our school at that time, one school. Second is that in these schools, teacher capability was very, 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 very low. And that also basically comes from the unfortunately broken BEd system that we've had for many years. And, unfortunately, the government has not been able to fix that. It continues to teach old practices, does not build a lot of skill in the teacher. So low teacher capability is the second problem we saw. And the third problem that we saw was that the school, classroom infrastructure was still stuck in the old 100 years, 60 years back situation where there's just a blackboard and a chalk. And there is no technology in the classroom. And the school has no technology. So really, there is no way for them to make database decisions. They're just making decisions based on principal walking the corridors, principal having a hunch about teachers and students, right? So I think those are the problem statements we saw, and the early solution of LEAD in our own schools revolved around solving these problems. And, that's what we first started solving for in our own school, the first school that we set up in Gujarat. We saw some really good results. So I think 3 years we just did that. And then when we started seeing really good results, and what I mean by good results is a very marked, measurable change in students through a student outcome measurement that we used to do periodically. That's when we said, hey, there is some model here. Let us now set up some more schools and try and impact more children. And, you know, we in fact invested some of our own savings. We set up 4 more schools in Maharashtra, rural locations, like remote locations. That's when we built our technology layer, because we said we wanted to be able to run this chain of really high quality, affordable schools. And as we developed for those schools, we just basically realized that we're on to something really good here, because in the first year when we moved from one school in Gujarat to these 5 schools, we just saw the student learning and the teacher improvement sort of replicate in a very short period of time. So we knew now that we had this model that was replicable.
Right.
And then we basically just put a lot of energy, Sumit and me, put a lot of energy in sort of making it into a robust product and thinking about how do we replicate this across multiple schools. Because given the, given the infrastructure costs that it takes to set up schools, I mean, we were clear that we're not going to be able to set up a lot of schools ourselves. And that's where really the LEAD journey as such, you know, in terms of the LEAD partnership model began back in 2016, 2017. And today, as you mentioned, Hari, we partner with more than 3,500 affordable private schools across the country who essentially use the LEAD system, the LEAD integrated system to operate their school. Which originally was built for our own schools.
Explain that model a bit. What is the LEAD system? What does it do? And you mentioned different points where you found problems, where you wanted to intervene. So maybe you can explain the model first, and then you can talk about how you're using technology to, you know, make those interventions more effective.
Sure. So what we've built is an integrated system. An integrated school system. And what I mean by that is there are 2 very important things we integrate. We've basically created very high quality curriculum that is contextualized for these students and teachers. And we've integrated it with school technology that transforms a school and moves them away from the old methods and old practices of running a school, which is largely textbook-based study, exam, sort of teach to exam, and then just give grades and move on, which I call more linear approach of education, which is, you know, you teach, you assess, you grade the kid, put a stamp on the kid and move on, to a more spiral learning approach. And, you know, that is what the tech enables. So we move the school to a high quality school, just like international schools would be, or some of the best schools in the world would be, where a lot of the decision making is done based on data and it is all centered around student learning. So that's really the system. Now, if I describe that a little more in detail, let me take the first part, right? That what I mean by high quality curriculum that's contextualized is that I mentioned earlier that our students came and come from very high learning gaps. Now, they typically have 2 to 3 years of English language skill gap, which means that they struggle to follow all subjects because all other subjects are in English. And they even in math and other subjects, they come with big learning gaps. And we need to design a curriculum for them that basically accelerates that learning and takes them from where they are today to grade level or above. And hence, what, you know, the curriculum that works in a normal high-fee CBSE school in a metro will not work in this environment. It needs to be designed differently. So it's a lot more visual. It's a lot more activity-oriented. It starts at a place where we recognize where the student's learning is today and we take them forward. So the example I'll give is our English program. We have an English language and general awareness program. We call it ELGA. ELGA is actually not a grade-based English program like most other curriculums in India are. It is a skill and level-based program. What that means is that in the beginning of the year, when a student first joins a lead school, we assess their current English skill level and then we basically assign them the right ELGA class, which is a mixed-age classroom often. And we normally, you know, the curriculum basically takes them or rather helps them build skill of more than 1 year within one academic cycle, because what we want is that in 2 to 3 years, we're able to bring kids to their grade level English language skill. And last 7 years consistently, we've delivered 1.5 to 1.6 years of average English skill development in one academic cycle with these low skill teachers, you know. So like, that's how the curriculum is designed. The other aspect of curriculum design is, how do you really make all these low skill teachers teach like excellent teachers in the classroom? Now, which means you have to really equip them with what I call microwave ready lesson plans, with all the tools provided to them, so that they really just focus on execution, you know, and we basically equip them to execute that beautifully. So a lot of the lead curriculum is also around very innovative pedagogy, very innovative classroom routines, that any graduate in India can actually use and become a really good teacher, you know. So it does not require extensive teacher training. The philosophy is, how do you get teachers to just execute your microwave ready lesson plans and build their skill? So, you know, so that's the part of the lead integrated system, which is largely on the curriculum side. The other side is the school tech, where basically, you know, these schools, you know, see, the only way you can change a system, a school ecosystem, is by getting them to do things differently. And I see tech as a massive habit change enabler. So, you know, tech that guides them to doing what is in the best interest of the student. So what I mean by that is, see, traditionally school timetables have always operated a certain way. On our platform, we actually recommend the ideal timetable for a school that works with us. We actually slot all their classes and we help them actually even figure out which kids are going to go where. Now, all of ELGA, for example, is enabled by our tech, where the assessments are done. We have multi-level assessments where, you know, we are able to very, very accurately, you know, see where the child's skill level is currently, and hence which ELGA class should a child go in. And those are the books that will go to the school, and the timetable of the school will be set in that manner. You know, that is one, like, that is one example, for you know, of our tech. Or a lot of our tech basically ensures that teacher action is based on data that she's constantly getting about how their students are performing, whether it is through data from daily homework, whether it is data from periodic tests that they're doing every week, or assessments that they're doing at certain intervals, and remedials happen in the school based on that. That same data the school principal is looking at, and based on that, they are altering their action. So, you know, school tech actually helps just transform this entire ecosystem. So if you walk into a lead partner school, you're basically looking at the school operating very differently from a traditional school in a small town that any of us would have seen, you know, where it's just basically principal walking the corridors and just knocking and checking if there is good behavior in the classroom, because that's not really telling you whether learning is happening, right? So I think that's how our solution works. And I hope with examples, I've been able to help you visualize what it would look like in a school.
Mm-hmm. So just so if I understand, and of course, I may be oversimplifying it, but you work with the school. So in that sense, you work within the system. And also what you have focused on is how things are taught and maybe to some extent what is taught, but largely focused on how they are taught. So they would largely follow the syllabus or the curriculum that they adhere to, whether it's CBSE or ICSE, whichever it is, but they follow your way of doing it.
Yes, absolutely. Now, of course, with scale, what we've done is there are a lot of variations or optionality that we're trying to bring for the schools, because as you expand across the country, of course, different states and different places, you know, different contexts come into play. Things are a little different in, let's say, a Tamil Nadu and the cultural context there versus, let's say, a North. And hence, how we've expanded our curriculum is as we go to higher grades, we have tweaked our curriculum, you know, for the context of these different states. And as you rightly say, I mean, of course, most of the schools that we work with are either CBSE schools or state board schools, largely state board, because we work with affordable private schools today. In the future, we want to work with even low fee schools. You know, what I mean by affordable private schools is they tend to be in the fee range of 12,000 per annum to 30,000 per annum. And these are largely state board schools. And yes, they follow our curriculum and they follow our school practices, all these different school practices that really helps them run their school much better. And they see significant benefit with student outcomes and with parents being very, very satisfied and happy because they're able to see their kids do well in school, which builds a lot of confidence in this partnership.
Tell us a bit more about the tech. Today, I'm thinking maybe you have dashboards at different levels that give people some kind of insight by way of, you know, measuring the end outcomes of how the interventions are working, whether it's in terms of the students learning. And you already mentioned the ELGA part of, you know, 1.5x. So for the teachers, is there an app where they can track what they're doing? For a school or as a whole, maybe can the principal look at a much sort of higher level or school level, what's happening, how these things being done with your tech?
So see, when you're looking at transformational technology in a school, right, because you're basically moving the entire academic operations of the school from an analog system to a technology platform, what that means in a lead system are, you know, following bits, right? One is that we basically convert our technology converts or we introduce technology in the classroom. So our classroom tech is essentially this low-cost tech environment where we basically install a TV in the classroom and we replace the textbook. We remove the textbook from the teacher's hand because we don't want her to teach, we don't want rote learning in the class. And we equip her with a tab which has the lead teacher app, which basically guides her every second on what needs to be done. And, you know, that's where the teacher behavior in the classroom changes. That 40-minute class, whatever subject it is, because we actually do full school transformation. So we work across all grades and all subjects. You know, that 40-minute class completely changes. So traditionally, if a teacher would have done, she'd pick up her textbook and she'll read and explain a chapter and then she'll do some question answers on the blackboard. In a lead classroom, what will happen is she'll come in and, you know, she'll basically follow a lesson plan, which will have an opening activity. We provide all the physical material that she needs for the activity. It's sort of linked and, coded in the lesson plan that we've given her. She'll start with a video where she can, you know, where kids can basically see stuff. And then they have lead books. So, you know, she will be able to get them to practice, right? So this classroom now becomes this very highly active, engaging environment. So that's the first and the deepest place where technology comes in from lead. And normally, you know, smart classes try to do that, but smart classes, unfortunately, because of them being very expensive, landed up being theaters, to be honest, in schools, where schools would typically have maybe two smart classes. And, you know, once in a week, a kid will get to go there and watch a video, like a movie, with no connection to learning, with no engagement there, because it was very tough for the teacher to connect that with what she's teaching, right? And here now, every lead classroom is technology enabled. It's a multimodal environment. Every lesson is basically getting taught in a multimodal manner. So that's the deepest part of our tech. And I think the part of tech that we're most proud of, because these are schools that are not in non-internet zones. Our tech works in an offline manner, you know, where there is only periodic connection needed to the internet, you know, in this very low-cost environment where schools, affordable schools, are able to afford the lead solution by just investing in this technology. In fact, we provide and install all the hardware for them. So that is the deepest part of our tech. And the second part is basically connecting all stakeholders on our platform. Now, what that means is teacher is now, of course, plugged in because we're getting live or very, very granular data about what she's doing in the classroom. And that brings a lot of insight. We are getting a lot of assessment data, you know, and we're able to give her insight with that, with, you know, ready remedial plans, telling her, hey, this kid needs that help in the classroom. And then we're also able to do that for the principals and the school owners, where they're able to both see which students need help, but they're also able to see which teachers need help. So we've also codified great teaching practices, you know. So a really good school works in a spiral learning manner. What that means is a teacher has to prepare, and then she executes the class based on the preparation. She assesses her students, and based on that assessment data, there's a feedback loop and what she needs to prepare differently. And this entire loop, you know, spiraling, we are able to do on our platform because each of these points get captured on our platform, and the principals and school owners are able to take action on it. So this is not only dashboards, but it is also recommendations on what should be done. And we are making our recommendation engine a lot smarter with time. And third important pillar here is really that is something that we've done over the last 3 years when COVID hit us, is basically connecting school to home with the parent's mobile, right? And which means that not only is a parent constantly aware of what's happening, but now even learning is connected at home, where students are actually doing practice at home for 10, 15 minutes, where they're submitting their homework, you know, where they're doing some practice tests, using their parents' mobile app. And that data is also sort of coming back into the system, which allows lead to become a lot more intelligent about offering better curriculum, and also allows the school to become a lot more intelligent and focused on what sort of remedial interventions they want to put. So I think that's really how the whole technology solution works.
And through kind of, you know, following your stories and some of your press releases, etc., I get the sense that incrementally you've been trying to make the measurement of the end outcomes more and more holistic. Most recently, you've talked about a student confidence index. Can you talk about that a little bit, explain the significance?
Sure. See, we've always, Hari, been anchored on student outcomes. So our North Star metric, or, you know, people call it North Star metric, or what is the driving, the most important driver metric for the organization is student outcomes. And we actually hold ourselves accountable to that goal, which is, we in fact commit that to our schools, which is, 1.5 years of English language skill growth and 70% plus mastery across all grades, across all subjects. And we have consistently delivered on it. The way very often mastery is thought of is assessments that are testing for just knowledge or memory. Lead assessments have always tested for application and for skills. And what we realize is that a lot of the conversation in the country is still around am I able to solve a numerical problem instead of am I able to apply that knowledge or that understanding in solving a real life problem, right? Mm. And so, you know, to start shifting the conversation around it, we basically thought of the LEAD Confidence Index, where we said, hey, what really gives kids the confidence to do well in life or to feel that they're ready to succeed in life? And if we break that up, it really is five core things that we see. One is very deep conceptual understanding of different subject areas. But then even more so, it is thinking skills, communication skills, collaboration skills, and then having the exposure to practice all of this in different environments. Mm. And that is what the LEAD curriculum has been doing for many years. And the LEAD technology is focused on delivering. And we were always measuring it internally. And it's just that, you know, with time, what we've realized is that there isn't enough of a outcome-based discussion in the external environment. And we wanted to influence that ecosystem. And that's where the LEAD Confidence Index idea came. It was also for us to start driving, more visibility towards small town India, where schools who are partnering with us are putting so much of effort in building these skills among students. But, you know, they're not really the most well known. And we also hence wanted to bring their voice, saying, what are they doing and how are they really preparing students for life, just like the high fee schools are in the big city. So I think these two, this intent came together to, the intent to drive an open conversation around this and move away from just, move away from just test prep and board exams and, you know, who came first in IIT, JEE and NEET. That is important, but that's not all. Hmm. Readiness for success in life is truly the most important thing in our mind.
Hmm. Okay. Let's switch to talking a bit more about the entrepreneurial side of what you all have been doing. You already mentioned 3,500 plus schools. Maybe you can delve into that a little more. Give us a sense of what LEAD has already achieved so far in the scale of your operations, the children that you touch on a daily basis. Maybe even talk about how you're growing and so on.
Sure. So, you know, as you mentioned, we currently partner with over 3,500 schools across the country in 400 cities. Of course, the scaling journey, we have rapidly scaled over the last 4 or 5 years. Even though the company was started 10 years back, the scaling journey is the last 4 to 5 years. I mean, for the first 5 years, we were just our heads down in our school and then in those four schools where we built the curriculum and the technology product, right? So, and this means that we today work with the whole school, all the way from nursery to grade 10, across the entire school curriculum. So we look at learning holistically from not the lens of subjects, but from the lens of readiness for life, as I was describing earlier. What that means is that we're constantly also looking at what are the new things that need to be brought into these schools to really prepare kids for the future. So coding and computational skills, in fact, is something that we introduce into these affordable schools at the same fee points that they normally pay 3 years back, because we were seeing international schools integrated into their school curriculum. And, you know, when the frenzy of these B2C coding started maybe after that or just around that. And we always believe that, this has to be integrated in school curriculum because the world is going to be a lot more technology enabled and the kids need to know how to build technology. So I think that's the length and the breadth of the impact that we make. And of course, in terms of student outcomes, I think is the other way we measure. Close to 1 million students currently, this academic year, studying with LEAD. Already this year itself, we've seen that they started with close to 50% subject mastery. There are learning gaps that have happened because of COVID, and already in 3 months, term one is not yet over, but we're already above 70% mastery across different subjects and grades. And that is really the guiding metric that we look at. In terms of course, organization, we are spread across the country. We are close to 2,000 employees working very hard to make this happen for all of our schools.
Okay, briefly tell us a bit about the LEED business model. How does LEED make money?
Yeah, so we partner with these schools and, you know, there is a per student fee that they pay us. Basically, the fees that they collect from parents, part of that fees comes to us. We replace their existing cost and just provide them a lot more in that. Now, what that means is typically they would be spending in buying textbooks and buying some, maybe one or two smart classes, buying some teaching learning material assessments. So we provide them all of this and the entire school, I mean, the entire tech platform, the entire curriculum at the same cost, you know, and we replace all of these products. And basically what that means is that we enter into long-term contracts with schools. So, you know, if you look at business point of view, this is a B2B sort of business. We partner with school ultimately to deliver benefit to the parent. And, you know, we do 3-year contracts with the school. Our part of the responsibility is to deliver student outcomes and help them through this transformation journey. Their part of the contract is to ensure that they follow the LEED curriculum and they basically have the right set of, they have the teachers in the school. They just need teachers. That's all they need to do. And we together basically deliver the promise to the parents. What we've also started doing, of course, is in any B2B business, it's very important that we drive business growth for the school owner. And that is also a big area of focus for us. What that means is that, you know, we basically drive a lot of admissions in their school because parents are looking for a LEED partner school. They're looking for LEED quality of learning for their child. And that, you know, when they reach out to us, we actually take them back to the closest school and get them admission there. And that's how we're driving the revenue of our school owners now. And we're constantly focused on trying to see what more we can do on our tech platform to bring cost efficiencies for the school owner. So really, that's really the approach. Or you know, it's a B2B business model. We sell to the school. It's like a SaaS model because we get into long-term contracts with them. And we provide our product and services to them.
Give us a sense of how you're growing. I mean, by way of revenue this year compared with last year.
Yeah, see, I think our annual results will get published soon. I think by the end of this month or something. But yeah, I mean, see, the, you know, we last in fiscal year 2021, we were around 60 crores of revenue. We've, you know, 21-22, what will be going out will be more than double of that. And this fiscal year 22-23 will again be more than double. You know, the good thing with our business is that we, because we work on academic cycles, we actually sign our schools and have contracts signed a year in advance. So we have visibility to our order book and our portfolio. And, you know, and which then just sort of gets realized in revenue. So sitting today with these schools, we have a good, you know, 300-400 crore sort of order book today and only growing, you know, at least 2x. I still see us growing 2-2.5x year on year.
Fantastic. And in the medium to longer term, and, you know, you already mentioned that you only started scaling a few years ago. The software that you're building in the back end, I would imagine that it will only become more and more sophisticated. So sort of in the, you know, in the, I don't know, 2-3 year time frame, would that also become an independent source of revenue?
See, I think I'm with you, Hari, that I think a lot of the innovation that we're doing on the software side is how do we basically improve the classroom technology experience very seamless, knowing the infrastructure constraints that exist in India, right? And the deeper, the, you know, for us, expansion means going deeper and deeper in rural India. And hence, how do we bring cheap but very, very reliable and high quality technology in these towns, right, or in these villages, and that is a big area of innovation for us as we go forward. You know, I think to the second, apart from that, I think the other two places where, you know, I see a lot of innovation happening from our side is how do we use the data that we get to constantly improve school operations and school action, and also constantly improve our curriculum. Mm. So if I take an example, like today we are in this place because our curriculum is fairly, you know, evolved, and we've built it over many years. We basically improve our curriculum every month by looking at the lowest performing, nationally lowest performing learning outcomes, which then means that there is a design intervention that we need, and we are constantly sending that out to schools, right? So how do we just make the curriculum that is available very smart and very good and very effective is the second big area of innovation that we look at. And the third big area of innovation that we are working on continuously is how do we connect, seamlessly connect school and home learning? Because today, one of the big problems is that home learning is absolutely disconnected. You know, what I mean by home learning is tuitions, what B2C players do, because they don't have any idea what's happening in the school. But what's best for the child is knowing what's happening in school and then personalizing that learning experience at home. And knowing that parents are spending so much, I think that's what we should be doing. So, you know, with that context, I really believe that EdTech is a lot, you know, to the customers, EdTech means ed. Tech powers that education, and only tech will not be able to make the impact that EdTech can. And hence, I still continue to imagine the future where at least where LEED will continue to innovate is going to be in the space of ed and tech. And, you know, we use tech to really, really power the education part of it. And that part is supremely important. And I still have, I have yet to see other players who are innovating there. I'm seeing a lot of only incremental improvement on textbooks, unfortunately, but not as much in the overall holistic curriculum and pedagogy space, in the school ecosystem. So that's the reason why I still continue to see this as an EdTech play versus largely a tech play, you know.
All right. Okay. If you'll indulge me for a minute just to kind of talk about my two bits as an observation. And someone as a tech journo and passionate about tech history, I was just thinking that anyone can spend 3 months and code some really sophisticated software, but they probably won't be able to replicate the decade plus experience that you have, you know, sort of blood, sweat, and toil that you have gained, which is where I thought, you know, in startup parlance, some people would probably call that your moat. And as, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about how, and this is one of the points that I use in why I asked you about software, but in itself as a source of revenue. I mean, maybe my example is not exactly apt, but I was thinking about Amazon building, you know, Elastic Cloud. They built it for themselves, but when they opened it up for the world, that really became the profit engine for the entire Amazon. So I'm just, again, maybe not exactly a sort of an apples to apples comparison example, but I'm just by way of, you know, thinking because of all the learnings that you have gained over the last decade, your software might in itself become a source of some crazy revenue down the line. I mean, just by way of an observation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that Hari, is an absolutely interesting space, right? And which is basically the way I interpret this is, or the way I think about this is, the engine that we've built, how can we use that engine with different types of curriculums in different places? Because, you know, curriculum diversity is also an important thing for the ecosystem. Now, whether we own that curriculum and we build that curriculum, or someone else owns and builds it, I mean, you know, we will be flexible about it as we scale in the future. So, for example, applications could be, as you were saying, like if you're looking at certain states where there is a state-specific curriculum that we want to look at, or if you look at partnering with the government at any level, where the government wants to be working on a certain curriculum, where we can bring in a lot of the intelligence from the data that we have today to be able to help them use our pedagogy, but use the content that they want to be using. So with you on this, though a little early still for us to be saying that.
All right. Okay. One more question on, in terms of, you know, experiences that other aspiring entrepreneurs can take away from your work. Did the VC money help? In what ways did it change things for you, in good ways or maybe in some unexpected ways? Did you have to make any compromises?
See, I think, of course, VC money helped us. I think they have been very critical to this growth journey. We were bootstrapped till the time we were running our own schools. And the first time we raised money, LOR came on board. That was 2017. That's when our partnership model began. And, you know, first year we signed up 35 schools. And then we went from 35 to 150 to 800 to 1600 to 3500 plus schools today, right? And through this period, we went from Series A to Series E, with first LOR coming on board and then Westbridge coming on board and then GSV Ventures coming on board. So absolutely, it's been, you know, they're very integral to this growth journey. My experience on this, Hari, has been that if you choose your stakeholders and your partners carefully, which includes the investors who you bring on board, because, you know, they're going to be with you on this journey for a while. If you do it very thoughtfully, you will not, as an entrepreneur, as a founder, get pulled in different directions. Now, in our case, what that meant was a couple of things. It meant that there is absolute alignment between the investors and us on the larger mission, on what we're really going for. Also, a very high alignment on the business model, that we ultimately believe that Lakshmi will follow Saraswati. What that means is we have to deliver educational outcomes and money will follow. That is, we will be able to then make money. They fundamentally believe that too. And it has meant that we have been very choiceful in who we bring on board.
Right.
And hence, from that point of view, we've not really faced challenges. Now, of course, when you go through the fundraising process, it's important that, you know, you're basically very clear in your mind about what is it that you are looking for in this investing partner, so that you don't get distracted once they're on board. And I think that is the only, I mean, it's also a learning, I think, for all entrepreneurs, that it's important you choose. Don't just go by, you know, who's giving you the best valuation. I mean, we've had a time when we did not choose the highest valuation term sheet. We chose the most aligned partner, because this is a long-term relationship. And hence, from that point of view, for us, honestly, it's only been very helpful in our journey. You know, you go through the motions of fundraising, and that one has to. But beyond that, I don't see challenges, because we're very, very aligned at the board level and at the investor level.
Looking ahead, obviously, the opportunity, and given the way you said you're growing, definitely seems to be to take your solutions to a much larger number of schools and therefore children who might benefit from it. What might hold you back? What is the one really big challenge that you have to be sort of aware of or tackle now?
You know, 2 years, 3 years back, I thought, I was not confident that we'll get past COVID. Because our fundamental solution and our fundamental belief was that schools have to change and improve. That we will not do band-aid solutions that are outside of school solutions. You know, we have to fix, or we have to improve that ecosystem, and hence school is our playground. That's where we will make learning happen. And from that same money that the parent is spending, we're going to really give them more value. We don't want them to be spending more on a solution outside of school. Now, you know, when COVID hit us, while we were doing what we were doing to make online learning happen, honestly, that is when I felt that our toughest times had come. Sitting today, honestly, I think our destiny, our growth destiny is in our hand. If at all anything holds us back, it would be because we have missed something. It's because we haven't been fast enough or agile enough, or we haven't been sufficiently self-reflective to see what we need to break from our old product and what we need to build going forward. Beyond that, I really don't think anything else can hold us back. If anything, you know, post-COVID, we only have tailwinds, where there is just a significantly high level of awareness among schools to move towards being technology enabled. I think school owners have become aware that as small and medium enterprises, you know, they have to be tech enabled in running their operations. I mean, you know, today, see, even a Kirana store guy is using tech, right, to run his business. So if I'm thinking of it from a business point of view, every school owner now realizes that they can't just continue to teach from a textbook and hope that things will be okay.
Mm.
So I think if anything, we have tailwinds, which is basically going to fuel the growth forward. And it's really going to be us, it's going to be for us to solve our internal growth challenges. And, you know, like any organization that is growing, operations become complex. You're handling so many schools. We are an integrated system, not only a technology system. What that means is that there are operational things that we need to solve for as we go deeper in India. There is a diversity of customers that we need to solve for on our platform. But I don't see any of those as big challenges. I see them as things that we can get past with a few months of good, smart thinking and work.
Okay. Anything about being an entrepreneur that surprised you, or anything you don't like, or anything that you really enjoy?
I really enjoy. I think what I what surprised me was, I have always been a person of very high grit and perseverance. I'm very, very hardworking, and I think I've got that from my parents. You know, I've grown up in an environment where I've seen both my parents work very hard to both make ends meet and bring their dreams come to life as far as their kids were concerned. I have one sibling who went to IIT Bombay, who's also an entrepreneur, and then me. And I think this DNA of working very hard and grit and perseverance really comes from my parents, right? So I've always been like that. But I think what surprised me was that the entrepreneurial journey will really test that about me. I can really look back today and say that the level of perseverance and grit and solution orientation that I have today is 100 times more than what I had when I got in 10 years back. Mm-hmm. This is what I love about the transformation it's brought to me as a person. I have grown to become a person who sees opportunity in every challenge. I don't get emotionally into a negative space at all. Whatever happens, the best example I can give you is of COVID. I remember the first school shut down in Bangalore. I think Bangalore was the first city that announced schools were shut down. Our kids were supposed to, when I said our kids, I meant our school kids were supposed to finish 3 more weeks of the year and then take their exams, end of year assessments. And we didn't want that learning to stop. So on 11th of March 2020 is when Bangalore announced school shutdown. 16th of March, in 5 days, we launched Lead School at Home, which was a completely online school, which we initially started with YouTube. And then we brought it onto our platform because we were just basically in this place in a matter of seconds. I recall it was a drive from my home. Sumit and me were driving from home to office, which is a 30-minute drive. And we said, hey, schools across the country will shut down. What do we do? And we went to office and we met a few people and we said, hey, come, let's brainstorm. What are we going to do? And here is what we should put together. And 5 days, 16th of March, we launched. And by on 1st of April, 800 schools started their new academic year in COVID when they didn't know what had hit them with online school. And I think that's that. I think when I look back, is it coming from a place of being very, very highly solution oriented. So we've gone from schools being fully online to school being online, offline, different parts of the country to now being fully offline. And, I'm like, yeah, we'll solve for each of these scenarios. It doesn't unfaze either of us.
All right. I know that we really have to let you go. I have two just quick questions. What is the division of labor between you and Sumit?
You know, as co-founders, it is very difficult to divide. So, but we do have, some internal functional division of work. So, he looks at a lot, directly works with the leadership on the growth agenda. And I directly work with the leadership on the, on the product curriculum and the P&L agenda. While we have that split, which plays to our historical strengths, we also, there are a lot of things that we basically just jump in and solve for, often together and often based on whoever is best placed to solve for that problem. And that's the reason why we are co-CEOs, because, you know, most of the leadership in the organization works with both of us. And there is this understood thing on if this is what we're solving for, are we best placed to go to Sumit or best placed to go to Smita? And, you know, we've figured that algo or rhythm within the organization. And, you know, if it comes to me and I know that I need to have Sumit's thinking, I will pull him in. So there is some structure, but there is also some flexibility, and it's a little more organic in some places.
All right. Last question is, you mentioned your parents a little while just now, and also you started out by talking about your father, and his comment kind of got me curious, and maybe it's a telling commentary on state of innovation in India. You said he thought India was not fair to engineers. I'm just wondering what the context was, what he meant.
I think he, you know, at that time, he worked with an industrial group where, which largely, I think the leadership comes from the, you know, chartered accountancy and the financial background. And he felt that finance and people who control the money have a lot more power. But I do think that has shifted over the last 20 years. I do think that has shifted. If there's anything that I would ever advise my own kids is, guys, you have to know engineering, right? Because right now, I mean, technology is what's leading the way. It's not necessarily finance. And I think his career was in a space when finance and legal professionals were pretty much running the country and running the business ecosystem, which has significantly changed over the last, I would say, 15 years or so.
All right. Smita, amazing conversation. I just don't know where the time went. So totally enjoyed it. Thank you so much again for making time for this, and definitely hope to keep the conversation going.
Thank you. Thanks, Hari, for patiently listening, and for all of the listeners. I also just noticed that my dad is on the call. So thanks, Dad, for joining. Yeah, thanks, Hari. Yeah, bye-bye.
All right. That was Smita Deora, co-founder and co-CEO of Lead. Wonderful conversation. That's it for this week's Startup Fridays. I will be back next week with another conversation. Until then, wherever you've been listening to us, I hope you're doing well and staying safe. Have a wonderful Friday and a great weekend ahead.